and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome to the show. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks filling in. It's my final day filling in, which is in some ways great news for some and sad news for others. And I think it's almost a split decision. Because I tend to, yes, for Tony and I, obviously, it's parting is such sweet sorrow. Let's be completely honest.
But I do miss sleep.
Yeah, that's true. That is a weird part of this whole thing. It's the whole sleep part. And considering how sleep deprived we have been, you know, normal to our own thing, I think we've done quite well. It might be the other reason why we're playing, you know, metal all the time. Just it's another reason to keep us awake. Okay, so I want to start this off with, there was an AP article that was also run in Salon in August that said the president cancels his trip to Russia. That the summit with Russian leader, you know, meetings with the Russian leader are canceled, and the G20 is not going to happen. And that wasn't the case, clearly. I mean, it's happening right now. That's where they are. And there's a lot going on. There is a lot of well-reasoned and informed and serious debate going on about whether or not we should take action in Syria. If we do, how should we? And if we don't, what are the other options and the ramifications of not acting? I mean, that's your national security debate in a nutshell, unless you have another input. 1-800-STEP-12. If there's another part of this conversation, then I'm willing to hear it. But that's pretty much the sides involved in tactical reasoning and logic. Okay. And, of course, we have seen a lot of clutch reflex freak out about the from leftover from the Iraq War and the bill of goods we were sold about yellow cake and mustard gas and a turkey farm. And we cannot let the mushroom pizza become a mushroom cloud. And all this BS that turned out to be not only wrong, in the words of Donald Rumsfeld, as if it was an accident of someone else's making, but fabricated. Old school Gulf of Tonkin made up claptrap. And mixed in with some regular hard evidence to give it some root base. Yes, absolutely, Saddam Hussein is a jerk. Yes, his kids are living the lives of the sons of evil dictator, you know, the son of Frankenstein methodology. And yes, they're awful and rapists and murderers and all that kind of stuff. No question. The irony is that, yesterday during hearings, we had a Republican congresswoman say that this is, you know, this president is not being resolute because he, by asking permission, he's just doing, you know, CYA, and he is in every way, like Reagan would have never done this. If Reagan saw this happening, he would act because he was truly a leader. We would never see anything from Ronald Reagan that would, by any means, you know, there would be no waffling. He would make his decision. By the way, this is Ileana Rosletnin, yeah. She's a Republican from Florida. The stand your ground state. Welcome to Florida. Get your hands out of your pockets. I don't trust your bang. She's the former House Foreign Affairs Committee chairwoman. She was on Fox News, and she says, I know. These are big words. And again, when we're parsing the details of stuff, when we're dealing with big issues like this, the word choice people have is very important. When McCain goes, I know them. They are moderates. I know them. I can guarantee that. I have met them. That means he's selling that to himself. Because in a political situation, and especially in a hot fire situation, in a civil war, you can say I believe. You can't say I know. You know what I mean? You could say, I truly believe. I could say, I'm very convinced. Can't say I know. Because you don't. And when she says, I know that President Reagan would have never let this happen. Never, never, never. He would stand up to this. He would stand up to this. This is what he said. And President Obama, the only reason he's consulting Congress is he wants to blame somebody for his lack of resolve. We have to think like President Reagan would do. And he would say chemical use is unacceptable. Now, she's arguing for intervention. Again, we've been doing a lot of history lesson this week because I think it's important to the context of what's actually going on. But let's be real clear. Not only did Ronald Reagan not stand up to, in any way, to chemical attacks like this if he didn't feel like it would move an agenda that he had forward elsewhere, but he was actually directly involved in not only the supply of weapons of mass destruction to Iraq, the supply of tactical weapons to Iran, but they gave troop positions to Saddam, knowing full well he was going to use chemical weapons on them. They were aware that he had them, because Rumsfeld's pharmaceutical company sold them to Saddam Hussein. And then they said, hey, we know you got these things. Good for you. Thanks for the old Bill Hicks line goes, Iraq, incredible weapons. How do you know? We looked at the receipt. Not only, a lot of people know that sale happened. This is the famous picture of Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein. And again, that's not enough of a reason to get freaked out. That single picture doesn't bug me. It's the other stuff around it that does, because a lot of world leaders have to meet with a lot of nasty people. And if we're ever going to believe that there are political solutions to stuff, there's going to be a lot of pictures of our rulers, our ambassadors, and our presidents shaking hands with people we think are awful in an attempt to direct this whole thing in another area. You know what I mean? I think when Bush is holding hands with the Saudi prince, like they're walking in a garden together, that's a bit weird. But the shaking or bowing that's normal to relations isn't that weird. And being even hyper-respectful when you're trying to jumpstart, that makes sense to me. Okay, so, but her argument is Reagan never would have done this. Not only did Reagan help supply them with it, but they actually said, we know where the troops are, and we gave Iranian troop positions, and they dropped those chemical weapons on them. And so when we say they use chemical weapons on their own people, we would find out less than two decades later that not only do we know they did it, we sold them the weapons that they did use on them, and we told them where the people they were going to use them on were. So needless to say, reason number 6,582, why people don't want to necessarily jump headlong into a conflict and trust that the government or the intelligence community, quite frankly, when they say this is what happened and this is what we need to do, a lot of us now, both by direct lies and incompetence that we've seen over the, if you have any idea of history, looking back, you start going, you want to put the brakes on. Logically, you just go, wait a second, we need to think about this. And I need way more agreement than just the president saying this is how it goes. Especially if the UN's not involved, if NATO's not involved, if the Congress is signing off. Then why would we want a president to go it alone again? Why would we be arguing after the failures of the Bush administration's tactical ideas of what war are, the lies that they fed us to actually do the wars that they wanted to have, the wars of choice that they proposed and executed, based on lies and poorly executed? I mean, for God's sake, man, the one thing you're going to do, if you're going to create a fake conflict so you can profit from it, at least pull it off well. For God's sake, man. When we come back, the reason I bring this up, and the reason why, I mean, it's not surprising that a Republican thinks that the sun shines out of Ronald Reagan's backside and heals, will cure your cancer. That's not surprising. The surprising part is the tenor of conversation about the president's choice of going to Congress. Cynical as you may be, don't you agree that's how it should work? And how will you ever expect another president, and I'm going to play you a clip after the break, to honestly want to go to Congress again and do this action again if this is the generalized reaction of the American people and everybody else, and especially the media? We'll be back. I want to play you some AP stuff that set my hair on fire. We'll be back. It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Ongoing train wreck aside, I love this.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Is it true that there is a place in a man's head that if you shoot it, it will blow up?
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in for Steph and the Mooks while they're away on vacation. And this is the last day of that. And today we actually get to, usually there's Fridays with Fuglesang, and apparently John is in meetings today. And we're keeping our fingers crossed that it's for what I think it might be for. And I won't say any more than that, but if you've seen John on television, you know that you want to see more of John on television. So I'm just, that's all I'm going to put out there. You know what I'm saying? I don't mean... I don't want to use the word moron in relation to John on television. I was actually saying more and on. And that's a very important step because you don't know how you're going to be cut together. I just realized I could be cut together, you know, because they can cut you up to make you sound like anything. Absolutely. Tony's...
I'm very good at that.
I know you are. As a matter of fact, we were having a discussion about how the White House spokesperson, in talking about the Syrian conflict during the thing, says a lot of ums and how that bothered you when she says... I think you'll find that, I think that, and by the way, I do that a lot on radio too, as I am dealing psychologically with like five different things I want to say, and I'm like, I have 3 minutes to a break, and I've got to get all these thoughts in at one point. So that's how my brain does the shuffle. It's not for lack of wanting something to say. It's an edit point. It's like old fashioned tape snip.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So, and there I did it again. And she, in that circumstance, I think, is doing that specifically because in our modern media society, one of the things we like to do is take a clip and air it and go, see, whether it's in context or not.
And 20 seconds is the sweet spot for
it
that.
It is. So one of the best ways you can keep your clip from being played, if you're saying something that's controversial or something, this is a lesson for all you budding political spokespersons out there, is you say a lot of uhs in those particular things, and you create artificial pauses in them so that they have to do editing work if they want to put it together. And a lot of people, a lot of reporters and a lot of media outlets are just too lazy. They'll just rather run to a firebrand and have them yell. And so if you're answering a question about something as complicated as Syria, what the commanders on the ground have said, and we have issued a statement to this effect, that's how you start saying that. If you want to say that thing, because they won't, they'll just read the statement. They won't play the clip. And that's what you want them to do. It's not an accident. They don't hire people who have a problem with, you don't get to that level if you can't do it. Okay. So when she does that, there's a reason for it. She's pacing it so that it has to be written and not recorded and done out of context. Now, that being said, Mike Lee from the AP is asking a question about the president's decision, after deliberating with his staff and internally, about his decision to go to Congress about this, considering, A, it's something he ran on, it shouldn't come as that big of a shock that this might be a thought that goes through his mind that he takes seriously. But in this case, Mike Lee doesn't think so. Mike Lee thinks that this is indicative of a problem that is specific to the Obama White House, apparently, and I want you to listen to his characterization of a president asking Congress to get on board with a military action. Let's play the first part of that.
What I don't understand, though, is how he is comfortable with the president's decision. I understand
he's talking about John Kerry.
The president is the commander-in-chief and that everyone is going to get on board with whatever he decides, but I don't understand why he is so full-throatedly in favor of this. He, over the weekend, said the president was acting courageously by taking this to Congress. And I don't understand what is courageous about asking permission for something that you say you don't need and to do what you believe to be.
Pause there for a second. And listen to that. I don't understand what is courageous about asking permission for something you say you don't need permission to do. As if this is simply that military action and the ramifications of military action are a cut and dry black and white mechanical decision. Like, I know because I'm a cop, I can run a red light. Why bother slowing down at the intersection? I know I have the right as a cop to go through the intersection. I know this. Yes, there might be traffic coming the other way, but it's their responsibility to look out for the cop. It's not my problem if I hit a minivan full of kids. I, as a cop, have the right to run a red light. And I don't even have to, there's no direct law that says I got to fire up my rollers 3 miles back or 6 blocks back or even a block away. I can decide at the intersection, boo-boo, and run right through it because that's my right. And if I don't see that car coming and I careen into them, sorry, I had the right to do it. And the state has to back me up. So technically speaking, yeah, the president might have the on-paper authorization to act like this, to carry out a military action. But the idea that somehow it's because you have that right, you have that legal line, that it's either a good idea, doesn't require anybody else's input, or isn't, it gets worse, by the way. And we're going to keep playing. But the fact that he doesn't think it's courageous, listen, it gets worse. Let's continue playing.
And I don't understand what is courageous about asking permission for something that you say you don't need and to do what you believe to be the right thing, not just morally, but in general. Can you explain why this is a courageous move and why the secretary would call it a courageous move?
Certainly let me first say, of course, the secretary does feel how he did on Friday, how he did on Sunday, that targeted intervention is absolutely the right step. And he does support the president's decision to bring this to Congress.
So, and was there some kind of like group spine removal procedure at the White House over the weekend? I don't understand. How is this courageous?
Okay, first of all, let's hold right there. Hold right there. This is an AP, Associated Press reporter. Now, he does occasionally work for or get his work reprinted by Salon. And Salon right now is trying to gussy up their readership by writing articles on you know, calling Eric Holder the house N-word of the Obama administration and stuff. That was a recent article in Salon. So if they're really shooting for this, is they're trying to fox their way out of a ratings pocket, you know, as far as sites. They're being intentionally incendiary at different times, whatever. But this guy's an Associated Press reporter. When you hear AP, you might as well hear Christian Science Monitor, you know, because those are the two biggest organizations that supply kind of generic news. Everybody else starts making their own version of the news out of it. But this is just kind of a generic, you know, you're like, oh, it's the AP, whatever. You know, it's just the AP. They just, this guy crossed the street. We saw it. Here's a picture of the guy crossing the street. Reuters shot a picture of it. AP said, yep, he was going left to right. That's how we perceive the AP a lot of times. That is not a fair assessment when you look at how Mike Lee is directing both criticism of the administration and the snarky friggin', you know, E! News Daily, like, it's almost like a Simon Cowling of the AP. So I ask you, is it courageous for someone who has the strength to act to ask that other people involved in the decision to use that that strength, since they will be affected by the use of that strength? If it's true, what would you do? We'll be back after this with your calls. 1-800-STEP-12. I'm Hal Sparks. It's the Stephanie Miller Show. Gary's on his way. Watch where he is. Because sometimes the old edit, they had a demo version of that that actually didn't say
demo
spit.
Version.
Oh, yeah, right.
I didn't hear when I was here. Thank you.
Yeah, watch where you spit was the same edit that they put in. And Yeah. So it's, phew, we might have dodged a bullet. So there's some calls coming in, and this is the question, and this is a real problem. Can we play the tail end of that spine comment again before we went to break? Because I want to take that we've got a few people online about this, and I really want to discuss this with people because it's amazing how many people, especially left of center, will say the Bush acted unilaterally and we should involve Congress when we do an act of war. The AUMF is not enough for this kind of a strike. And there are people on the right who go, the president should act unilaterally when he's white and his dad used to run the place, or he's Ronald Reagan in the case of that. But this president has to ask us permission because all black people have to ask us for permission. Let's be honest. That's what that is. But seriously, like, they're still arguing about his right to be president. So, of course, they think he needs to ask them. But at the same time, they think it's just all bluster. You have to bluster your way through this. You don't involve any consensus or the building of consensus or even the conversation of alternate points of view is a sign of weakness. Listen to this little piece at the end of it.
Was there some kind of like group spine removal procedure at the White House over the weekend? I don't understand. How is this courageous?
Mike Lee, let's be real clear that Mike Lee, as the reporter and the spokesperson for the Associated Press, yesterday believes that dictatorship is strength and democracy is weakness. Because that's what this is. That's the question. Because resolute belief in something and your belief that you should be able to do something is not enough in a representative democracy. It is when you're Bashar al-Assad or you're Saddam Hussein or Kim Jong-un or something like that. You can arguably act because you think you're a supreme leader, you're allowed to do whatever the heck you want to. That doesn't make you stronger. Your mental and psychological weakness might actually be the cause of the damage to your country. But nobody else gets to put their two cents in without their head getting cut off or them just vanishing. But somehow Mike Lee is cool with that. That's right, I said Mike Lee is cool with the type of leadership that gives us mass graves and messianic, like, according to Mike Lee, and I'll say this unequivocally, Jonestown was a sign of strength. And churches who have regular leadership, and if their preacher said, drink the Kool-Aid, I said so, go, wait a second, shouldn't we all talk about this? Is somehow the weak road to Jesus. I mean, follow the analogy this man is making. What do you think? Let's go to Aldous in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Aldous.
Hey, so, you know, I am, and I will say right now, a very strong and loud critic of President Obama on the left, but I will say this much easily. It is definitely a sign of courage that he's going to Congress with this, because let's face it, on a basic level, he is going to be in so much more of a bad position if Congress does not give him the approval. So for him to go and chant that they would say no is a sign of courage. He says, you know what, I believe so strongly in this, and I'm going to try to convince everybody else of this. I'm willing to take the risk that Congress is going to say no and put me in this really awkward position.
Okay, yeah, I agree.
That's courageous right there.
I totally agree. I want to float an idea and see what you think about it. Let's say the president is not stupid, and he's aware of this situation. He's also aware of the knee-jerk need for military posturing that both the American Congress, certainly the right has done, and they are intransigent in Congress. They don't want anything through unless it's super macho and anti-Obama. He knows this about them. He'd be silly not to. Let's say he didn't want to take direct military action in Syria. He really didn't want to. But if he went straight to the other options, it would undermine both the 2014. It would also undermine our ability to actually act in the region, because we would be undermined by our own people, a la people like McCain going and meeting with the rebels without approval of the State Department, that kind of stuff. So the best way to do it is to go, look, I want to bomb the crap out of them. I'm totally for bombing the crap out of them. That's my favorite idea. I like it. We're going to do it targeted, and it's going to be cheap, and I'm going to do it right away, even though he doesn't want to. and watch everybody else have to flip out because all they do is contradict him, and then find another way to solve this in 90 days.
Well, you know, I understand that that could be a legitimate strategy, but I will tell you what it will reap him, and I'm telling you this from somebody who has seen it happen 4 years ago. He's going to invite another 2010 on Congress, because right now, anybody who backs Obama, and thankfully a lot of Democrats aren't, so maybe that won't happen, but anybody who backs Obama right now is going to be suffering a major amount of wrath, considering how much of America has no desire for us to be involved in Syria at all.
Okay, I understand that. But let's say, for example, that our, you know, because we're using an element of prescience to deal with that. We're looking at, look at how Iraq went, and that's where we're picturing this. What if he gets into Syria and we're stuck there and we stay there and it doesn't work out and all this kind of stuff? But arguably, Kosovo ended up being an elevation of Clinton's presidency at a certain point, especially during, you know, it was almost the wag the dog aspect of it. But it worked. In that respect, it actually strengthened his position, so much so that when Gore moved away from him and didn't campaign with him, and that stuff was seen as a sign of weakness, and it actually kept him from being within the margin where the fact that he won the election could be hidden. Now, what I'm trying to say is that there are a lot of Republicans who, if they don't vote for a war strike against a Muslim leader in a Muslim country that was laid out basically by Bush. I mean, you know, when you and I hear Wesley Clark hear about that memo from the DOD, we go, that's scary to us.
Oh, yes.
When supporters of Bush heard about that, they're like, well, yeah, that's a great idea. That's bumper pool.
So, yeah, well, here's the thing that I'm thinking about why I don't think this is Kosovo. In Kosovo, I don't think you were looking at nearly the kind of international entanglement you are with, as you are with Syria. Honestly, I'm thinking we're looking at more like Pearl Harbor, wherein the Japanese woke America up and started World War II in earnest by attacking us with a surgical strike on non-U.S. soil.
So you believe that Syria is effectively the sleeping lion in that analogy?
Yes, basically that by doing that, we're probably going to wake Russia up to be a very nasty hostile. I mean, let's face it, Putin and Obama haven't exactly been getting along very well this past year. This is really not going to do anything for their relationship. And seriously, I could see this becoming Russia's Pearl Harbor.
Gotcha. So you believe that an attack on Syrian chemical weapon sites or the sites perceived to be chemical weapon sites will be taken as an act of war by Russia and push us into a greater conflict, not with Iran or the Alawite or Shia that we've been fighting for a long time in the alleged war on terror, but that this will dovetail into a Russian-U.S. hot war?
I don't see that being terribly unlikely. Put it this way, Tom Hartman, who you had on yesterday, has a very important message for us on this. The meaning of a communication is not what you think it is, it's what the receiver perceives it to be. We're saying this isn't war. What's Russia going to think?
Well, Russia sold them the chemical weapons that they're using.
Yeah, but that's why they're invested in it. That's why I'm saying this is their Pearl Harbor. Syria is not Russia, but Hawaii wasn't America either.
Understood. What I'm trying to say is that, and I'm getting a lot of feedback, so I gotta let you go. And we have other calls too. Let me grab those right there. I think that, for lack of a better phrase, that's a long shot. Let's go to Frank in Albuquerque. Hey, Frank.
Hi, Hal. You know, in my house, we already have one dead, one disabled combat veteran daughters. I voted for Obama to change his war policies. You know, these chicken hawks don't get it. We were at a fight, a handful of serious foreign terrorists on the street of the USA, then keep funding this overblown world policing, military, CIA, industrial complex. You know, I want to put a stake in the heart of this lifeblood-sucking entity before it destroys us all. You want to talk about taxation without representation? You know, these sick, twisted politicians talk about an obligation to every other nation on the planet. What about the obligation to the American people? Remember, of, by, for the people? You know, our so-called representatives in government have failed miserably at that the last 30 years. And 50 million Americans struggling below the poverty level is all the proof one needs of that. You want to talk about a red line? I passed my red line about halfway through the Bush and Cheney administration. We got to stop this madness. How much money does the USA have to borrow from communist China to police Syria?
Understood. I will say the bigger problem as far as what money we borrow to do these kind of things is not China. That's been floated a lot. That China, and it's worse, actually. China owns 8% of the U.S. debt, and they do it through bond purchases just like everybody else because they believe it's a secure place for their money in some ways. You know where the vast majority of America's debt comes from? The Social Security Trust Fund. We're not borrowing it from China. We're borrowing it from our elders. And that's worse. We could pay back another country over time. They can deal. They can make sure that their elderly are taken for by budgetary shifts in their own thing. We are taking food out of the mouths of our own people to do these kind of things. The other thing is that I think there's absolutely, and I appreciate the call, too, obviously, there's a huge amount of passion about this. The issue is it strength to involve this Congress, or is it weakness? I have my own opinion. I'll tell you in a second, but I want to hear more of your calls because we've got a bunch of them. 1-800-STEP-12 is the number. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm filling in, and with everything I say. I know that. That's true. We'll be back right after this. 1-800-STEP-12, and I'm at Hal Sparks on Twitter, and we're streaming on Ustream. If you care to see me, you can wave. Hi, how are you? And you can see Tony on occasion, too, if he ducks his head up. Yeah. We'll see you in a minute.
Come on, it's brilliant.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show. You are the sun, I am the flame. You are the blood.
Welcome back to the show. I could be just another stranger, but to you, I guess I'm just another fool. Good old Ozzy. Touring with Sabbath right now. My girlfriend saw them last week. He sounds terrific. And their new drummer is the hotness. Everybody's flipping out about him. Like, she and all her girlfriends were, like, all tweeting at the same time about how amazing his drum solo was. And I was like, drum solos? People like drum solos again all of a sudden? I'm like, I feel like I've died and gone to 75.
Ozzy's always really good at picking good backup people, you know. I
think, oh, yeah. Well,
you know, with all the Ozzy band guys and stuff.
Well, and Tony and Geezer are there, but they basically stand still the whole show and just hold it down, you know, while Ozzy throws buckets of waters on people and goes, get on your feet! And, like, everybody's already standing, and he doesn't understand that. It's awesome. Anyways, 1-800-STEP-12 is our number. This, you know, I'm talking about the strength argument and the credibility argument, because that seems to be where this is boiling down to. The hawkish argument seems to lie in two directions. Go to war right away, because this is about our manhood as a country. And if you don't act unilaterally as a president, somehow you are not being courageous. That is not the courageous thing to do. That part worries me. And I wonder if it worries you. Let's go to Ron in Chicago. Let's go to CPT,
Hal.
I think. Yeah.
Hey, Hal. Yeah, it's interesting that you brought this up. I was thinking about this issue yesterday. Just to let you and your readers know, I mean, I'm a veteran. I've been deployed a couple of times. I'm still in the National Guard. So if we do go to war, I know I'll be going.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so it's
right.
Not, you know, for me, it's a little bit.
You have, quote unquote, skin in the game, as they like to use that term a lot.
Exactly. You know, like I said, I've been deployed 2 times. I mean, you know, one of those times was before my daughter was born. The other time was my daughter was 2. So I missed about at least a year,
sure,
you know, being with my daughter. But let me get back to my point. Is it's interesting you mentioned the strength versus the piece of strength, because you know there's because you know a lot of Republicans like to use the strength versus peace through strength, and a lot of Democrats like to use the strength through peace argument. And I think what's kind of missing with this is there's kinetic strength and then there's potential strength. And kinetic strength is really what we don't need, because kinetic strength, what we're talking about is when you mean strength.
Kinetic strength is what we absolutely already have. We have 6 times the military of everybody else combined. You know, we don't, it's not like we're lacking for military strength.
Well, Well, when I mean kinetic strength, I mean like kinetic strength meaning that action, like we're actually doing something.
Sure.
Like when I mean
yeah,
like,
that the only result comes from physical activity on our part, bombing, whatever.
Activity.
Yeah. Sure.
Right. Now that's something we don't need to do because every time we move with kinetic strength, I mean, we're always moving. We're always constantly using resources, things like that. And having a strength, you know, peace through strength with kinetic strength, we're gonna run ourselves ragged. We're gonna run ourselves out. We're gonna run our
sure.
resources down. Now, when I say strength, you know, peace through potential strength, what I mean is that we have strength. We build up our military, but we don't necessarily have to use them every single time, you know.
I totally agree. That's not the single solution in this situation. And I appreciate the call. Let me get to, because we're near the end of the hour, I want to make sure we get a couple of other folks in that have been holding. Let's go to Tom in New Mexico. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Hal. How you doing?
I'm good.
That is an interesting way to present the question, weakness versus strength. There is weakness involved in the president's decision, not weakness in his character, but weakness in the fact of what happened in Parliament when probably our strongest ally backed away.
And yeah, but so, is that I will question one area of that, which is can we be out-democracied by another democracy in that situation? He went, as much as he felt like he could do something, he went to Parliament, and Parliament said no. That was their democracy in action. That was their actual parliamentary democracy actually doing its job. And so can we as the United States go, no, other democracies can argue this, but we're not that kind of democracy. We're unilateral.
I agree. I mean, they made the decision. What this president has the capacity to do is to reevaluate a situation as it's in flux.
Mm-hmm.
And he did reevaluate it.
Right.
And instead of forging ahead like his predecessor would have done, what he did is he analyzed his options.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, you know what? In fact, a lot of the language he used was the same language that David Cameron used. Well, this is a democracy. I'm going to present it to the people's representatives.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, used the expression a minute ago, the skin in the game.
Right.
He wants the Congress to have skin in the game. He wants us as citizens to contact our representatives and tell them what we want.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so we're all involved in this in a way that we were not involved in the decision in the run-up to the Iraq War.
Right. That, I think, is the most amazing. Okay.
Anybody who says that this president isn't strong is forgetting his decision to send the SEALs deep into Pakistan
mm-hmm.
to capture bin Laden or to make sure that they had bin Laden. A weak, cowardly president would have sent in drones or would have sent in cruise missiles.
Or would have said, I don't really think about him anymore. You know, I don't really think about
him. Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So, you know, the thing is, Obama continues to amaze me in mm-hmm. his ability to, and he's not playing games. What he's doing is he's seriously and soberly analyzing the situation as it's ongoing. And, I'm just amazed at this man.
I agree. I appreciate the call. It's fascinating to me, though, that it is boiled down to, and how much time do we have left before we got to take you back? Yeah, we got a couple minutes, so we can take an extra call. I want to get to Janet in Maryland because I almost took her there a second. Hi, Janet.
Hi, Hal. How you doing?
I'm good.
I want to go back to something that you mentioned a while ago. It was kind of a quickie comment that I think a lot of people may have missed,
mm-hmm.
and I want to thank you for it.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a young kid, I paid into Social Security. It was called the Social Security Trust Fund.
Right.
We don't call it the Social Security Trust Fund anymore. We call it Social Security, and we talk about people who are expecting money from the government. Seniors aren't asking for anything from the government. They're asking for what they were promised because they put into it. And you're right. The reason that Social Security, they keep talking about it going bankrupt soon, is the fact that the money's not there, not because it's been paid out to seniors, but because it's been paid out to finance many, many conflicts around the world.
Exactly.
And I want to thank you for making that comment because the word trust fund doesn't seem to be associated with Social Security anymore.
No, you recall that Gore kept going, I'm going to put it in a lockbox. And what he meant was we're going to start separating this from the general fund because that's what we're doing. We're just borrowing from it willy-nilly as if it's this – well, the roof's never going to leak, and people are never going to need this. It's childish. And thank you for noticing. And I wish other people did. We got to take a break. We're right up against the bottom.
Thank you very much for bringing it up.
Absolutely, Janet. Thanks. We'll be back after this. More of the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. Taking your calls, 1-800-STEPH12. And in the next hour, the angry black lady, Moni Gandhi, will be joining us.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks, filling in on my final day while they're away on vacation. It's been a great week. We've had Tom Hartman. We've had Jano and Danielle. We've had your calls, which has been the amazing thing. This is, again, I'm dead serious. Tony just made a face. Some of them are a little off. I understand that. And some of them have a great point but don't get to it quick enough. And there's some of them that prattle on and never get to one. And I can be accused of both of those things during the course of my week here. So I have no judgment about that at all. That being said, on the line with us right now is the angry black lady herself, Moni Gandhi. Thank you for joining me at such short notice. We need you to talk about a bit of this conversation. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, how are you?
Hi. So I'm good. I'm just watching President Obama is doing another press conference in St. Petersburg, Russia right now. Where it is 6 p.m. And he said something. He's talking about he was asked a question, why not go to the Security Council? Why don't you just go to the UN Security Council? Yeah, this is illegal without the action of the Security Council. And can I, since you're here, can I say something that he can't say?
Sure.
Because I think you'll agree with this. I think he can't say this. I would love to go to the UN Security Council and get a vote on this, but the truth is the veto that is in place is being put in place by Russia, who sells the chemical weapons to Syria. Why would they ever let this get through?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good point. And I also think that I would have a real problem if Obama would have gone forward with these attacks without the backing of the Security Council. So I think the question becomes, at what point do we really need to take a look at how the Security Council operates, how the UN operates, and how we're supposed to handle these sorts of genocides, or as some people are calling it, patricides, since Assad seems to just be out to destroy his own country, irrespective of the ethnicity of the people that he's gassing and murdering.
Right.
At what point do we as an international community decide to step in? Who decides to step in? And how do we do it? I mean, that's my concern. My concern is, A, whether or not we have enough evidence that shows that Assad specifically was behind these chemical weapons attacks, and not that these chemical weapons attacks came from some other, either rebel group or some group we don't know about that got these weapons either from us or from Russia or from whomever. I think that Obama did the right thing going to Congress. I am still very much on the fence about whether or not to go in or not. Not because I approve of, gassing children, and I have a real hard time dealing with people, especially on Twitter, who are passing around photos of dead children and using that to make the argument rather than wrestling with the really true hard questions, which is what do we do as an international community?
Right, right. I totally agree. It's almost like anti-abortion people holding up pictures of fetuses and saying that makes the argument for why women shouldn't be able to make a choice about what to do with their lives.
Right.
Or even contraceptives. That's at any point. This is also the back and forth that there's been a lot of revisionist history about this stuff. Let's play Donald Rumsfeld on Great of Ancestry. I'm sure you heard his stuff about, it was Colin Powell who had bad information and the intel was wrong, but we were right to act on it. And so take a listen to this.
He says he didn't draw. It's drawn by the international community. You've got a Congress.
He didn't draw it.
I'm telling you what he said.
You're kidding. I didn't see that. This president has tried to find a way to blame everybody or anybody for everything. And leadership requires that you stand up, take a position, provide clarity, and take responsibility.
And is that one of the known knowns or known unknowns?
Right.
Or the unknown
knowns? That's exactly what I was going to say. You go with the war. You go to war with the information you have and not with the information you want. I mean, Donald Rumsfeld is the last person that I want to hear talk about anything to do with war.
And accountability. Right.
And accountability for war. And frankly, you know, he and his cronies, you know, Wolfowitz and all of those jackwagons,
yeah,
are the reason why so many people in this country are war weary, and the reason why perhaps before the Iraq war debacle, we would have had more of a stomach for going into Syria.
Right.
And Syria is not Iraq. I mean, people are making the argument that Syria is Iraq, and I don't think that that's the proper analogy to make. Now, the question becomes, in my mind, and the question with Iraq back in, you know, 2003 through, you know, to when Obama ended the war in, 2011, is what happens after we attack? You know, I understand that there's a chemical weapons ban. I understand that the world stage has decided that these weapons are particularly pernicious. But the issue still is what happens afterwards. I mean, we can't just, I don't imagine that we would be able to just waltz in, drop a couple of bombs on specific military targets, and then waltz out and just see what happens. You know, what fills the vacuum in
right.
Syria once we do that? And I think that's the question that I'm wrestling with, and that's the question that a lot of intelligent people that I follow on Twitter and talk to are wrestling with. It's not that we want to stand by and watch people get gassed. It's what happens afterwards. Are we going to make the situation any better by surgical strikes,
right.
by military strikes? And I haven't heard a good answer to that question.
Right.
So that's why I'm still on the fence.
Sure. There are surgical strikes that have been going on since the beginning of the Civil War. And they have continued by an ally of ours, Israel. Israel struck Latakia on July 5th. They dropped bombs on a Hezbollah-backed militia group's weapons cache.
Yeah.
And these were Russian weapons, heavy tank weapons, and that kind of stuff. That were all sitting together, and Israel bombed inside of Syria. They've done it at least three times that we know of, that it's been overt. Basically the exact same thing we're talking about doing with just different strikes. There hasn't been, at no point has Russia decided to go to war with Israel. They haven't used, you know, the idea that that Syria would be a bank shot to us being in a war with Israel is like saying, well, if, you know, that by attacking Syria, and, you know, Russia would retaliate against Israel to get to us. It's a lot more complicated than that. And quite frankly, it has been going on. There have been surgical strikes, just not based on our intelligence of where chemical weapons facilities may or may not be and those things. Israel has been striking like this multiple times, and it has not escalated in that regard with them. And they would seem a closer and more, you know, Syria and Israel have a history of actually having a hot war before.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I'm really also uncomfortable. I was uncomfortable with the hearing that took place the other day with Kerry sort of saying, oh, they're not going to be boots on the ground. Well, maybe they are. Well, maybe they're not. I just don't think that. I don't think the government.
I don't think that's what he said. I think what he said was, and they did this with the general as well. Was people were going, have you drafted up provisions for the war escalating in Syria and spilling out over borders into Israel and stuff? Well, the answer is, of course, yes. That doesn't mean that they are planning to go that direction, but it is the Department of Defense's job to draft a plan based on every logical and some illogical contingencies, no matter what. That's what their job is. You're supposed to. You know what I mean? That's just the business that they're in, no matter what, good or bad, whether they act on it or not. Believe me, we've all been frightened by the contingency plans that look like depopulation schemes that have come out of the Department of Defense or the CIA over the decades. There's a lot of weird thought bubbles floated at the CIA and reported up, but that doesn't mean they were ever actually taken seriously or that they actually will get implemented. So of course he has to do that, and of course, as the Secretary of State, it would be disingenuous, I think, if I was the Secretary of State, I could not conceivably say we have not thought about what would happen if Syria retaliated at Israel and we actually had to do this. You of course have to think about that, but that's because you're supposed to. Right?
Yeah, I mean, you do, but I just haven't heard any clear, you know, cogent analysis of what would happen. You know what I mean? And I think that's what makes me nervous, is this idea that we're going to go in, we're going to do these strikes, and, and then what? Like, I want to know the answer, and then what? And people have told me and insisted, well, we're, you know, it's not our job to decide and then what, because we're going in for a specific purpose, and that's because chemical weapons were used. Well, I haven't really heard a good analysis of how good this intelligence is, and I think that probably stems from my fear about what happened with Iraq, you know, with this imminent mushroom cloud.
Yeah.
I just don't trust the intelligence, and I think that's sort of the place where a lot of Obama supporters are.
Yep.
I trust President Obama. I don't really trust a lot of the people that are surrounding him necessarily.
Or giving him this information. Yeah, that's
or giving him this information. I don't really trust the military industrial complex, because it seems to me there are, you know, periods of time that we always have to have a war. You know what I mean? It's like, okay, now that we're getting out of Afghanistan, now we have to go get into another war, because we always have to be at war. This country always has to be at war somewhere. And I get really concerned when I see articles, like there was an article recently about how Raytheon stock has jumped since President Obama started talking about Syria strikes.
Oh, yeah.
So then that raises concerns about, well, what are we really going to war for? I mean, yes, perhaps we are going to war in order to stop the gassing of children, or are we going to war to line the pockets of defense contractors?
Right. Let's take a break. Can you stick with me through the break?
I sure can.
Okay, great. Yeah. Hang on for a second, and we'll come back to this, because we're talking to Imani Gandhi. She's angry black lady on Twitter, but I think that doesn't even stand up to the value of her conversation. And if you want to hear more from her at any given time, you can go to thisweekinblackness.com. When we come back, I want to discuss that very issue, both the strength of waiting versus what we're hearing about we can't wait. From certain quarters. It's a bit spooky. We'll be back right after this.
Join the party. 1-800-STEP-12.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. Still on the line with us, Imani Gandhi, the angry black lady from This Week in Blackness. And she's also, by the way, a contributor at Progressive Voices. If you get the Progressive Voices app and you can listen to all your progressive favorites on radio on your smartphone, and you can, you know, do like most people nowadays are doing, which is plug your phone into your and replace your radio with it, which happens a lot. You can listen to this show and every other the exact same way. There's no skin off our nose. We don't care how you hear it, just that you hear it. Imani, obviously the manhood issue is the part that worries me, because trying to drive an argument that we'll look weak. Are you with us? Are you there?
I'm still here.
Yeah. trying to drive the argument that if we don't do this, they'll laugh at us, or they're, you know, the idea that they've been handing out, you know, they're popping champagne in Tehran. That's what I heard from a Fox News contributor, that, you know, this is, you know, a sign of weakness that this president is, you know, if you think you can act unilaterally, then you should just go ahead and do it. That's really the argument.
Well, I mean, frankly, the rules that have been applied to President Obama and whether he decides to strike in Syria are vastly different than the rules that have been applied to any other president. And I honestly think that this Congress is willing to do anything it can do as long as it doesn't do what President Obama wants to do.
Right.
And, you know, there are sort of these, you know, 11-dimensional chess arguments that are being made that, well, maybe President Obama didn't really want to go, so by kicking it to Congress, he sort of knew in the back of his mind that they would waffle. And I don't think that we can go into war, or not that we would be going into war, because, you know, we would be doing these strikes. But I don't think that we can do that based on some notion that the United States needs to flex its muscles in order to be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm pretty sure everyone in the world understands that, you know, the United States is sort of this military power. You know, people throw around the word imperialism. I don't think that's going to change if we don't strike. I think that's a ridiculous argument. I think the issues at hand are far too complex. The lives that are at risk are far too great to be boiling down the argument, down this argument to, well, President Obama's going to look weak.
Right.
I don't like it that people on both the left and the right are making this issue more about him and his administration, as opposed to whether or not this is going to solve anything in Syria, whether or not we're going to end up killing more civilians than would otherwise be killed, and whether or not it's going to create a vacuum where even more jihadists or people that are adverse to United States interests are going to take over and turn it into a mess.
You saw the president's press conference like everybody else did, and when he said, "Here's what I believe. This is what I think. You know, we have a responsibility to do. However, my generals have told me this plan will work tomorrow, a week from now, or a month from now." Because here's the thing: in reaction to people who have been killed in a battle situation, those people are going to be just as dead a month from now, and it's the only reason to act quickly is if you believe there is an imminent attack or one that's planned that says more people are going to be dead like that very soon.
Right.
As if conventional death is not, you know, we've been ignoring the 100,000 so far. It's the 1,400 that were killed this way that's finally been our, you know, why it's a moral imperative to jump in between them and the weapon. But that being said, you know, he made a distinction. Look, we need to do this deliberatively, and it will work even if we wait a month. But
right.
The reaction has been, no, it won't. It will only work, and it only shows manhood, and it only shows respect, you know, for our allies, and it only shows our strength if we do it right away. Don't think, just do it. Act on this immediately. Lindsey Graham, and this is how you know you're on the right side of history. If Lindsey Graham is coming out and against your idea of how to act, because that we act is not so much a question with a lot of people. It's how. Yes,
right.
Something has to be done about this guy, and yes, something has to be done about chemical weapons, but there's variety. Do we bomb or do we use sanctions? Do we freeze their assets? Do we start, you know, eliminating trade routes and all kinds of other stuff? Does that help or hurt the rebels more or less? Blah, blah, blah. But here's what Lindsey Graham said. If we don't do something about Syria, it's going to spread quickly. That in and of itself, that sentence makes me think we need to wait and watch. We need to take as much deliberative time as possible because if that statement is true, we have all the reason to act we need because it's spreading quickly. Oh my God, we didn't do anything. Boom, it's starting to take off. Now we have a real obvious reason for everybody to go, you're right. You know what? And it doesn't change our position long term. But if it doesn't spread quickly, and it wouldn't have, and this would have been a mistake, it's too late if we act quickly.
There's nothing wrong with waiting and deliberating and making sure that an action that we take is the best course of action.
Especially something this important that involves more dead people.
Exactly. And it's just, I have a real, I understand that there's a chemical weapons ban. I understand that. But I have a real problem with this notion that, oh, because now Assad is using this particular, may be using this particular mode of killing his people, now all of a sudden we have to do something.
Mm-hmm.
Because whether or not he's shooting people or gassing people, people are still dying.
Yeah.
100,000 people have died already in the last 2 years. So this notion that we have to do something right now, that's just not something that fits well with me. And especially because, you know, at the time at which President Obama was thinking of acting, the UN hadn't even finished doing its job yet.
Right.
And I think that's what happened with Iraq is that, you know, Bush went in and said, you know what, we're not waiting. We don't care if the UN hasn't done this job. We don't care if the UN has the UN inspectors haven't found these weapons of mass destruction. We need to go now.
Right.
And look how that turned out.
Exactly. And so we finally have a president doing exactly what we clamored for all during the Iraq and Afghanistan war, all during, you know, never mind the fact that as soon as one of the reasons why the right gets to talk about the budget, you know, deficit under this president is because when he came into office, he stopped putting the cost of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars on the emergency supplementals, keeping it off the budget so we could pretend it didn't exist, and borrowing it again from the Social Security Trust Fund, borrowing it from, you know, foreign investors and what have you, and never putting it on the actual table, budgeting it for real. And then this president comes in and goes, no, we're paying for this. This is a real part of how we're living right now, and we need to look at the money we're spending on this war. And suddenly that makes the budget deficit go up as if it was his fault. And that's nuts. The same thing. We were clamoring, please don't do this budgeting through emergency supplementals. And he's not. And everybody's allowed to bitch about the deficit. Then we go, please go before Congress before you do these kind of things. That's what the Constitution says is what we want as people. And he does it, and everybody's literally clamoring like, this is weakness. This is a lack of strength. I have to, we got to take a break. I thank you, Imani, so much. You're awesome. Angry Black Lady on Twitter. This Week in Blackness. We'll be back right after this. With an amazing shift. Wow. from David Lee Roth, because if you don't, he will. That's the amazing part. What I've always loved about David Lee Roth is you don't always have to like him because he likes himself enough to make up for the deficit you may have created. And I'm exactly the same way, by the way. That's why I'm able to facilitate this conversation. There's a great conversation, by the way, going on in our chat room about this, because there's a lot of variety in this. The phones are lit up, and we're going to take a bunch of calls right now in dealing with this. Insofar, there's two things. Insofar as our, what I think we should do, if there's been any question, even though I've said it a couple of times, I believe in targeted strikes of chemical weapons depots if they exist and we have evidence that that's what we're hitting and that indeed the Syrian regime used those weapons. If the Syrian regime has those weapons and a group of rebels found them and set them off in a way, in an attempt to set the international community to create an imbalance that they can act on, that's not the same thing, and that doesn't require that type of response. I'm for, once we find out that it's actually sarin, and that's what actually was used, which is why the weapons inspectors were in there in the first place, once we know that that's exactly what was used, then who used them? And you need to find the best intelligence that says that was an actual thing. Now, they say that there's people who say that the State Department, the NSA, and all those guys have phone call conversations that the orders were given, and that's really only going to come out in committee, so you're going to have to trust your representatives and ask them if they believe that that's the case, your senators mostly. But that being said, I don't have a problem with us intervening. I think there are areas where, to me, this equates with Kosovo or Darfur, you know, one place we did go and one place we didn't, and I think there's arguments for what kind of action is used. But I don't have a problem with military strikes as a point of order. I just think we need way more information before I'm cool with that. And that's why I had Imani on or whatever. And there seems, just to clarify, if I have a problem with strikes in general, it's the same thing with drones. I don't buy the drone. I don't think automatically drone is a scary word for me, the way people use that as a knee-jerk reaction, because I think it hides our the action itself. Is it an imperialist act or is it a security act? And a drone can be used for both or neither. And if you just talk about drones, you totally remove yourself from the argument about whether we should be doing something in the first place. And you also create this fictitious idea somehow that that soldiers on the ground or airplanes overhead would somehow do it better with less collateral damage, killing less people in the process. And you get to have that argument kind of freely without, you know, Cornel West style, without ever discussing whether or not we have security needs in this world and whether or not those security needs are being met by the action at all. If you just talk about the delivery system and think that's the devil, you're missing the whole point. So there's how I stand on it. I'm going to take a couple calls, and then I'm going to tell you there's a bit of an amazing revelation from the a spokesperson. White House Deputy National Security Advisor said something that I think is very promising. Let's go to – who's been holding the longest? Let's go to Jeff in Chicago. Listen on CPT, I guess. How you doing, Jeff?
Hello?
Yeah.
Oh, doing great. Thanks, Hal, for everything you're doing. I mean, Allah Akbar.
Thanks, yes. For God you bless and you, too, and I hope your God is great as well. Yeah.
But –
Admiral Akbar to you as well.
Thank you. On the issue about the strength, I think a lot of previous callers have talked about there's different ways to perceive strength, and mm-hmm. I think that's the real question. You know, what kind of strength are we talking about?
Strength or machismo?
Yeah, and unfortunately in our country, I think we're very materialistic, and I mean, someone like John McCain perceives strength entirely differently from any of us.
I would say singularly. I think he has one version of it. And it, there is no variety, and if there is any variety, is weakness, which is what that Matt Lee business is all about.
Yeah, I wanted to make two quick points that I haven't heard much about.
Okay,
inadvertently or not, I think what Obama has done by throwing this over to Congress mm-hmm. is exactly, you know, is something he's probably pretty happy with. Look at all the discussions, not just on your show, but nationwide, globally, everybody in the world is talking about chemical weapons.
Right.
And Obama, when he was working with Lugar and non-proliferation causes on WMDs, mm-hmm. you know, he's got some background here, and he's got to be pleased that there's this much discussion.
Right.
I kind of wonder if he's already won some ground.
Well, he clearly has, because the interesting thing is the conversation is shifting to, is Russia okay with the weapons that they're sending to the Syrians being used this way? And as the more that conversation comes in, I bet you'll start to see a shift in the UN Security Council's feeling about it. It's, you know, everybody's still reacting to the unilateral reflex that they had last week to what he said initially, like the first 10 sentences in his speech versus the follow-up. Everybody's still reacting to that because they're so used to that being all we get from from America that they think that's really all we mean. Like that he can't be serious. He's really going to go to Congress. He's really going to try to get the international community involved. They really can't believe that. So they're still reacting to that. Now they're starting to react to the second part of the address, which is people need to give their opinions. And worldwide, you're right, there's an explosion.
I also want to mention the congresswoman that I have my eye on in this is Jan Schakowsky.
Mm-hmm.
She's progressive.
Right.
She's on the Intelligence Committee. We'll get a classified briefing, and she's also from Illinois, so she knows Obama. I'm guessing that they have a pretty good working relationship.
Yep.
So I think it'll be real interesting to see what she thinks.
I totally agree. Thanks so much for the call. Let me grab some of these others because we've got a ton of people getting in there. Let's go to Alden in Virginia. Hey, Alden.
Yes, hi. I was actually thinking that Obama did say there's a red line, chemical weapons, and the whole world is really pretty much behind him on that. But I think the way he's responding is maybe what we need to modify. And so I was thinking that what he should really do is, since he's in Russia with Putin right now, sit down with Russia and say, here's that. Let's take the chemical weapons off the table. Let's you and I march into Syria, tell Assad we're collecting the weapons from you and going to store them in safekeeping in Russia somewhere because Assad trusts Russia, and just take them off the table.
It's an interesting point. Although here's the thing, I don't know necessarily that the relationship between Obama and Putin is such that they would be doing a collaborative walk-in to pick up weapons, especially considering two things. Considering our relationship with the concept of how Israel and Syria and Iran feel about Israel, and considering how Russia seems to feel about the United Nations, the U.S. Particularly right now, and about gay people, this is what the president has done in the last 48 hours or so. When he was in Sweden, he brought up Rosh Hashanah, and he spoke very openly about the Jewish New Year and wished everyone a Happy New Year, and talked about a Swede there who had saved Jews during the Holocaust, which is, you know, famously the last guy who ran Iran is a Holocaust denier. That same, within 24 hours of that conversation, by the way, the new president of Iran wished Iranian Jews and Jews throughout the world, but especially Iranian ones because they're locals and, you know, I guess he's a local kind of a guy, a Happy New Year. And people can't believe it's true. A lot of people think it's fake. But then his, the guy in charge of, you know, their foreign policy in that regard did the exact same thing. Wish Jews in the world Happy New Year. In the same 40-hour. Okay, that's nuts and amazing and pretty spectacular. Then he goes into Russia. Obama's in Russia, and he just met with LGBT groups about the oppression that they've suffered under under Putin's regime right now. So he's not over there patting Putin on the back, even in that guy's backyard. Now, you want to talk about the courage of leadership? Like, he did ultimately, by the way, have a private meeting with Putin. We're getting a report that happened. But before he met with Putin, he met with LGBT groups in Russia. And I know what everybody's going to say, window dressing. It's just the Illuminati is controlling the earth and getting us to fight over abortion and gay rights and women. And if you're not a gay, pregnant, or a woman, in that particular order, these don't matter. This is all just window dressing. I don't buy that either. But let's go to Carolyn, Sacramento. Hi, Carolyn. Paul in Illinois, and then Carolyn. Hi, Paul.
Oh, hi. Hi, Al. I just want to make the point with all this that we Democrats, we elected Obama and gave him our confidence,
mm-hmm.
and but then we t- typically sort of cut our Democratic leaders off at the knees. I don't see Republicans do this. They'll get behind a leader,
right.
And I see so much second-guessing and armchair quarterbacking. That's what really bothers me. If people start saying, well, I trust Obama, but, you know, I'm not sure I trust his, what he's getting in advice or the information he's mm-hmm. getting. You know, I elected the guy, I voted for the guy because I thought he was smart enough to do that for me.
Right. And it seems to be playing out, by the way. I mean, and when I say that, there seems to be this knee-jerk, oh, you're an Obama bot and an apologist and blah, blah, blah. That always happens. You're not even allowed to go... Maybe the rest of this plays out because it turns out you're going to have a chance at getting a single payer system, let's say, using Obamacare by buying it through a different single payer from a state point of view instead of one big federal system. That actually seems like a better version to me. And a lot of people who are going, we can't support Obamacare because there's no single payer, ultimately aren't now going, oh, you know what, I was wrong. They're not doing that. They just do that, and they're doing the same thing here. They did the same thing when Sonia Sotomayor was getting, confirmed. She's never going to get confirmed. They're using the Wise Latina stuff. He's not fighting for her in the same way. All these different things are happening. He's meeting so many of his goals and getting a lot of the stuff done that we would like to see done, but he doesn't get credit for it because of how he does it.
Well, not only that, I think that maybe sometimes he's got to make some compromises that he wouldn't otherwise have to because, I think that we undermine his strength when we act this way. And when I hear people that I normally really like and admire and respect, start to question Obama, and then I think, well, how do you expect then all the other things in the agenda that we want to accomplish over time mm-hmm. to really be there? You know, another thing I think that there's a lot of people that blindly maybe follow the Republican leaders just because there's that feeling of, they want to trust them. They want them to be the leaders.
Well, that's absolutely. I appreciate it. We got to take a break. When we come back, I'm going to get to more of your calls. 1-800-STEF-12 is our number. I think, you know, there's been a lot of news about how the people on the right tend to like the idea of leader. They need the leader. They like that concept of leader. They like to be led in that regard or feel like they are that person. Whereas the Democrats tend to view as, you know, in terms of consensus until it actually plays out. And then somehow we have this snap reflex. We want a leader too. Those are cool. I want one. Like it's an action figure. We'll be back right after this.
My word. What a gorgeous way to wake up.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Start school tech ready at Office Max. Save on the new HP 11.6-inch TouchSmart laptop on sale for just $329.99. This remarkable price includes LoJack for laptops anti-theft security for 90 days. Details in-store or at officemax.com. Office Max. The hot deals start here. Offer ends September 7th. Restrictions apply.
At Hotels.com, we've got thousands of deals for every occasion. Father's Day? We've got a deal that day. Earth Day? Hotels.com has you covered. Your mom's dog's cousin's birthday? Chances are we've got a deal that day, too. But we'll check with legal. And low prices, we've always got those. Because Hotels.com is always making sure we've got the best deals for you every day.
And now to September 9th. Save up to 30% on your favorite Texas and Florida hotels. Book now only at Hotels.com. Finding you the perfect place at the perfect price.
Hiya, Fred.
Hello, Beth. Say, I thought Eddie was going to finally break down and buy you a new car.
No, I might have to hang on to this one a while longer.
Well, how's she running? Still dependable?
Yeah, that's what we count on the folks at Parts Plus Car Care Center for, to keep us going and safe on the road.
They do a good job, huh?
The best. Wouldn't go anywhere else.
Parts Plus. Have to remember that for next time.
Oh, we'll remind you.
Yeah, knowing Eddie, I'm sure you will.
For the location nearest you, go to PartsPlus.com.
Public cloud.
Cloud security.
Cloud app crowdsourcing.
These days, a lot of people are talking about the cloud. At Kronos, we're actually doing something with it. From the Fortune 500 to thousands of small and mid-sized businesses, our innovative time and attendance, scheduling, HR, and payroll solutions are helping organizations of all types increase revenues, lower costs, and improve customer satisfaction. Learn more about Kronos Cloud technology at Kronos.com. Kronos. Workforce innovation that works.
Rates, policy forms, and availability vary by state. Did you know that life insurance rates are near record lows? If you own life insurance or are thinking of buying any, why spend more than you have to? I'm Byron Udell, founder of AccuQuote. Since 1986, we've helped hundreds of thousands of people just like you save a fortune on their life insurance. Here's how we do it. We monitor the products offered by dozens of the most well-respected brand-name life insurance companies you trust so that you get the lowest rates. For example, a healthy 40-year-old can buy $500,000 of 10-year level term for less than $21 a month. 20 and 30-year rates are also available. And don't forget to ask us about the new term life plans that guarantee your money back even if you don't die. Take 5 minutes and call AccuQuote for your free quote at 800-589-0469. Find out how much you can save on your life insurance. Call AccuQuote today at 800-589-0469. That's 800-589-0469.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Hi, I'd like to report a bear hug.
Okay.
Well, before I left my campsite, I was putting out my fire, and out of nowhere, Smokey Bear showed up and hugged me?
So you drowned the fire, you stirred it, drowned it again, and felt that it was cold?
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah. He likes it when people correctly put out their campfires. He's pretty big on wildfire prevention. He's just letting you know you did good with a hug. He's a hugger.
I just got a bear hug from Smokey Bear. Status update!
All right, I'm going to let you go now. I've got a lot of ranger stuff to do. There are many ways to start a fire, but one sure way to put it out. Learn how you can do your part at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service Ad Council and your state forester.
Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks. I'm a Shockwave. The band of 15-year-olds. This is true. These guys were 15 when they recorded this record. And the playing is just amazing on it. Stuff. Just, yeah, a lot of fun. So, I'm going to continue taking your calls. We got it. I mean, there's a lot of this stuff. Let's go to Lawrence in Minnesota. Hi, Lawrence. Lawrence?
Hello.
Hey, there you are. Hi.
All right. Hey, how's it going?
It's going very well. Thank you. Go ahead.
I love it when you sub for Steph because you really have a handle on the issues.
Thank you, sir.
Now let's go with the issue. Now everybody's been talking in respect to the angry black woman. Mm-hmm. I agree with her. I usually do, mm-hmm. But. We're talking about here, nobody's addressed mentally what's happening to Obama in Congress. Here it is mentally what's happening. You have a strident, an obtuse, and a bellicose GOP party, mm-hmm. and you have a president that's trying to appease that party and be liked, which he will never be liked by that party. Mm-hmm. So when you mix those two ingredients together, you have a volatile situation that's now to the precipice of having American lives at stake. Okay. Initially, it was not a problem. The problem was, okay, health care, we can be strident on that, and we can show our opinion, but no lives are probably going to be lost because of that. But now we have a problem where lives are going to be lost. You have ingredients here that is really volatile.
Is there a situation, though, in your way of thinking that lives will be lost if we don't do anything?
There is a situation, you know, and you have to look at that in mm-hmm. this frame of reference. Lives will be lost in Syria. That is tragic. But America, we have an infrastructure that's crumbling. We have a shaky employment situation that needs to be firmed up. We have to look at American interests first.
It is a common thought form. I completely agree with you in that respect. That is something we hear quite often. Thanks for the call. Let me play a bit of Alan Grayson. This is, you know, and I full disclosure, I went on the Progressive Voices cruise with Alan Grace, and we went on a cruise ship with a bunch of true believers, hardline progressives, and had panels and all kinds of stuff. Rachel Maddow joined us for a short time. She did a Q&A herself. It was a very valuable experience when I, of course, kicked her butt at basketball, which is, since she's almost a foot taller than me, is kind of amazing. Yeah, I did. I won. That's right. But this is Alan Grayson, and I think he gives the worst reason for the best course of action of anyone I've ever heard. This is Alan Grayson.
Most people understand this is simply not our problem. This is not our problem to solve, and we're not going to be able to solve it.
But that sounds.
There's nothing we can do that.
That sounds a little morally obtuse to me. I mean, to say.
Oh, sorry.
Well, no, but if, I mean, to say, I'm being totally honest.
That's how the American people feel. Overwhelmingly so. The calls are running 100-1 against intervention.
Well, the American people can be wrong about things.
No, listen, they're wrong about this. And they get a right to decide. They're the ultimate vote here. It's the intensity of feeling. People don't want war. It's not that they're tired of war. It's they're disgusted with war and anything that looks like a war. And that's exactly what this is.
First of all, I agree with Chris Hayes. I think that it is morally obtuse to make that argument that it's not our problem. That is that's a very common argument from the Ron and Rand Paul crowd. And I do think that in situations like Darfur and other areas, it is our problem. In the lead up to World War II, it wasn't our problem until it was. And I'm not conflating the two, but I think that as a knee-jerk reaction is kind of silly. The other thing is to just use the generalized how people feel about stuff without taking into context how they feel about the fact that they were lied to leading up to it. That it's not that Americans aren't disgusted with war. Believe me. If they thought we had a clear and present danger and they were really feeling threatened, believe me, there's a huge swath of this country that couldn't wait to do it. They would force the president to do it, which is arguably what McCain was trying to do by meeting with the rebels before, which is what, that wing of the Republican, the neocon crowd is trying to do. But the argument that somehow, hey, it's not our problem, man, it's not our problem, is morally obtuse. It's not the right reason. Expensive and dangerous? I'll give you. There must be contingency plans to make sure it's not unnecessarily expensive and unnecessarily dangerous to us. That's the reality. But the idea that somehow we can't walk and chew gum at the same time, that we can't take of our infrastructure and do a limited strike in a situation like this, is like saying, Israel's roads are rolling up because they've struck three times inside Syria, if not more. That's a weakened argument. I like the president's argument. We are too strong to make this a gut reflex. Instead of, we're too weak to just do it. That's odd to me. Let's go to Carolyn in Sacramento. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi.
Go ahead. You're on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm a retired Social Security claims representative.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to tell you that, all these people talk about Social Security's broke, blah, blah, blah. Social Security has a $2.8 trillion surplus.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, it exists in the form of IOUs from the government.
Right.
The government actually owes Social Security more than it owes China.
Right. Oh, by far. I mean, I think it's 21%. Whereas, 8% of our national debt is held by China out of 12% foreign, I think, altogether.
Right. Mm-hmm. And the thing is that they started raiding the Social Security Trust Fund back during the Vietnam War. Congress, they wanted more money. The executive branch, whatever, wanted more money, and Congress wouldn't agree to it. And so they looked around for sources of funds,
right.
And they went, ooh, and that's when they started.
Yep, they started raiding it, absolutely. And that's where the argument is from. But the problem is, when you have the right wing and they want to go to war, if they don't want to go to war, or they don't want to take an action or work on infrastructure, we don't want to borrow money for China to fix these things. They don't borrow money from China any more than they borrow from anyone else. But if they say, I don't want to borrow money from the Social Security Trust Fund, that means they have to give value to it. So it's easier to say China, demonize that as the borrower of choice. Whereas Social Security, we don't like it to start with. We'll be back right after this.
Ladies and gentlemen. and gentlemen, it's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. We're in the final hour of my fill-in this week. And John couldn't join us today, and there's obviously a serious gap in the conversation when that occurs. And the only person I could think of that could fill it as aptly is the inimitable Lee Camp, who, if you haven't, you're not aware of the Moment of Clarity or his regular vlog, you need to be. Lee, welcome to the show, man. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Absolutely. So, LeeCamp.net is the site, and I, you know, join, support, the Moment of Clarity exists because of people like us. And then here's the funny thing is, in the very fact that your vlog is called the Moment of Clarity must be really difficult in moments like this, because the maintenance of clarity, especially on an issue like this, is nearly impossible. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it is really tough to, like, see, to put all the players together. It's a pretty complicated novel going here.
Right. And so we just got word, apparently, this is in the Washington Post, that the White House Deputy National Security Advisor, Tony Blinken, said that the president, of course, has the authority to act, but it's neither his desire nor his intention to use that authority absent Congress backing him, which is the opposite of what, again, most people thought was going to happen last week. Everybody immediately thought the drum up meant the drum up. We were going to be bombing by Friday night, right?
Right. I think a lot of things changed since then that probably changed the calculation, like China and Russia voicing their concern, and the UK Parliament voting it down. I think that was a big shock. So, yeah.
Do you think that they were really shocked at the UK doing it, other than the fact that I guess we were used to them kind of towing our line during the Bush years?
I think it's the first time they haven't towed our line on bombing in a long time.
Right, yeah, that's, you know, the surprise might, you know, it just comes from almost a knee-jerk reaction, in the same way that the public kind of viewed, well, if the president says we're going to bomb something, you can talk all you want, we're going to bomb it, trust me. That's an odd thing that might actually be shifting. I mean, we never heard language close to this out of the previous administration.
I mean, let's hope it keeps shifting, because it's insane. You've got the entire American public against it. It's less popular than Congress, and Congress is less popular than Ebola. So
right.
It's truly amazing. And you know, Alan Grayson, who's been kind of leading the charge against going to war or bombing Syria, is saying that the calls coming in are 100-1 against it. And then, of course, you have all these countries against it, and the UN against it, and, you know, Ban Ki-moon saying it's illegal. So it's like, how many things need to be stocked up in the
right.
No column?
Absolutely. I do remind people that, technically speaking, the majority was for the Iraq War when it was actually going through, and that doesn't mean they were right. You know, that you know, the majority reflex doesn't always reflect truth. We see that a lot. And just because the UN, you know, again, like the Security Council, for example, and, you know, of course, China and Russia have a veto threat with that. Russia's arguably the one supplying chemical weapons, if they exist at all, with the Syrian regime. They have not even tacitly distanced themselves from that. So, but it's, again, it's hard for that moment of clarity. So what's your red line? Where do you think, how does this policy play out?
Well, my take on it is, isn't it funny that we always seem to say we have the humanitarian reasons to go into countries, but they're always the countries with, like, oil or major geopolitical influence, you know, that we want to go into anyway. And it's kind of like a lifeguard saying he's there to save the day, but then you notice he's only giving mouth-to-mouth to the hot chicks, whether they need it or not.
Right.
Meanwile, the ugly fat guys are drowning in the
splashing
pool.
Splashing out there with a shark bite, right.
At some point, you got to be like, I don't think that guy's actually here to save the day.
Right.
Like,
he might actually be here to drown me.
If I'm not attractive enough.
Right, exactly.
General Wesley Clark gave speeches and interviews several years ago where he said that, you know, people at the Pentagon told him we were going to invade or upend seven countries, including, you know, Syria, Libya, Lebanon, Iran, Iraq. And most of them have become true, mm-hmm. and this is on the list. And so it doesn't seem to me that this actually has that much to do with chemical weapons. You know, I mean, at the same time, we just inked a deal to sell cluster bombs, more cluster bombs to Saudi Arabia, like, and most countries have banned cluster bombs as war crimes. You know, we're not one of them, but still, it's, mm-hmm. where do we get this moral high ground?
Right, right. And then also, you know, again, it's hard to even kind of carve out where does, you know, American military might fit into the humanitarian aspect of things? Because, you know, mm-hmm. regret over Darfur, for example, is often floated as a legit reason for where right. we should have, but we didn't.
Right.
And it's not because Darfur in that area of the world doesn't have resources. Exxon has a pipeline that goes through there all the time. The BP president who was complaining he wants his life back after the Gulf spill, the reason he said that is because the head of Exxon dumps that same amount of oil into the Congo every year. Just nobody's there to videotape it. There's no fishermen with any, you know, recourse fighting it. So
right. I'm just spitballing here, but maybe it's because Sudan was already upended.
Right.
We didn't really need to,
yeah, right.
to flip anything on its head.
Right. And it's like we're drinking your milkshake, you know, there will be blood style. It's
we're drinking your milkshake, yeah.
Which is the argument Tom Hartman made yesterday that, you know, that there's all this really gooey oil in the part of Iraq that borders Syria, and it'd be a lot easier to truck out or pipe out if we send it through Syria as opposed to down through Iraq. I think,
yeah,
you know,
yeah. I mean, there's a lot of complicated
right.
geopolitical
aspects of that
here. I mean, apparently Saudi Arabia has wanted us to bomb Iran for a long time, and
that's,
you know,
not going
to
happen.
This could also be their chance to try and make that happen.
But
so. It,
mainly because the new president's actually a lot more, quote-unquote, liberal. This guy's a total shift. I mean, he really is. From their normal standard, you know, Holocaust denier saber-rattling, the guy wished the Jewish people of Iran, you know, happy Rosh Hashanah yesterday.
Right.
What?
Right.
You know, and that's when we have to go in. Like, you know what's funny? Here we are. We Iran's a big threat, and they're awful, and we can't go in, you know, because they're dangerous, and we don't want to do quagmire. But the second they get somebody nice, we're like, we got to point the guns, you know?
Yeah, well, that's the sign of some shady stuff going on when they wish us happy Rosh Hashanah.
Right, but again, that's not, you know, in lots of parts of this world, before we started monkeying around with them, and again, I know you mentioned this on the Moment of Clarity, that the CIA, you know, you gave a piece of, I think you called it, you know, old new news or something along those lines.
Right, right.
The CIA admitted they deposed the Shah. Now, we always knew it, and it was not
right.
a surprise, but they literally said, yeah, we actually tipped the balance illegally, and that guy, we did that. And no wonder they kind of hate us for a while. Now they've finally gotten back to where maybe they might have a person in charge that's more akin to the kind of world they were before all this awfulness, before we deposed that guy. This might have been the direction they were headed. If we'd have just left it alone, they might have eventually gotten to a peaceful position a lot sooner. But we can't have that. We need
their
stuff.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like we actually think of the long-term repercussions some of the time. I mean, we don't actually know. I mean, who are we going to bomb in Syria, and how is that going to solve these problems, and who is that ultimately going to put in power? You know, I mean, Al-Qaeda's fighting for some of the rebels, so it's a very complicated situation, but it's the old thing with when your only tool is a hammer, everything's a nail.
Right.
I mean, we spend so much money and time and effort on military that we only know how to use the military to solve everything.
Right, exactly. And again, we don't even talk about, because we're doing humanitarian stuff right now, we're giving more money to the refugees that are getting out of there than almost any other country, if not all of them combined at this point. But it's almost like we'll be accused of being, you know, weak, gay, pink, and commie if we talk about it. Whereas if you talk about what we're able to bomb, then that's a great conversation. That's great TV. But you know, packets of food is somehow, you know, gay and commie and pink and weak and feminine and girly. You know, it's a man
issue. Maybe if we could talk about new technology. You know, Bill Hicks talked about having smart food that you could drop from airplanes into people's mouths.
Right.
If we just had cool new technology, maybe then
It'd be all right.
Right. David Bender and I were saying yesterday, we do want boots on the ground, but just boots. We should just drop boots. Everybody gets, we're going to drop new clothes for everybody. Here's, we don't care what you do with them. Just get dressed and go to work.
I'm a big fan of that. Only boots on the ground.
Yeah, just real boots. Right. Just boots. Thanks, Lee Camp, by the way. LeeCamp.net is the website, the Moment of Clarity, and you can follow at Lee Camp on Twitter for, you know, these snippets of clear thinking. I appreciate your work, brother, and it's good to have you on. Thanks for joining us last minute.
Thanks, Al. Keep doing good work.
Absolutely. You too. All right. We'll be back right after this. More of the Stephanie Miller Show and your calls, 1-800-STEPH-12. You know, it's so funny. I keep getting this, like, yes or no, do you support a strike? As if that's the only option, as if that's, there are no other conditions, or there's not a debate going on. That really is it. There's a debate going on. And you know why there's a debate going on? Because this president made the debate valuable. There was a debate under the Bush administration. Just nobody listened. It wasn't even on camera. Now it's everywhere. And I believe this president gets credit for that. We'll be back right after this.
No need to thank us. It's what we do.
Who the hell are you guys?
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. I'm Hal Sparks filling in. We got another half hour or so, and it's going to be good. The president is actually going to give a serious speech on Tuesday. Watch the ratchet up conversation. There will be two tacks that now people will be taking, considering his last statement. The people who are for intervention will go, he's probably going to waffle, and we need to get Congress to enforce this because we need to go. And he still has the right to not even ask, and he's a weak leader because he even bothered to ask. That'll be the other part. And then the other group will be saying, he already decided, and this is window dressing, and this is going to be just like the mushroom pizza that turned into a turkey farm and some sarin gas, like, speech. That being said, I got a couple of hitbacks from Marie Scheer 1 and Green Dems about I guess dealing with what I said about Alan Grayson's reasoning for this, and I stand by it. I like Alan Grayson. I've supported Alan Grayson a lot. I've spoken with Alan Grayson. Alan Grayson will be one of the people who, if he disagrees with you, will say it in no uncertain terms. So let me be abundantly clear. Out of due respect for Representative Grayson, I agree that the American people don't want to do this. I agree that the majority of people want to see more evidence before they would ever do anything like this. I don't agree that the main reason is not our problem. I think Chris Hayes was right to say that's morally obtuse. I think when Alan Grayson says it's expensive and dangerous, that's where he's on to something, and that's the case he should be making. But the idea that somehow, you know, honestly, those are their babies. You know, we can't take care of everything, and that kind of that's pullback isolationist behavior. And like, it's not enough. It's not enough of a reasoning. Sorry. And if you don't like it, tough. I, like Alan Grayson, don't necessarily have to care. That's how he does it. So here's the thing. Let's take some of these calls, because there's a lot of this going around. Let's go to, Abraham in Los Angeles. Hey, Abraham, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Fantastic. Go ahead, real quick, because we got a bunch of calls, and I want to get to everybody.
In 1939, the United States sets on its hand and let Hitler kill people.
Mm-hmm.
Now many people want to do the same. Israel has the drones flying over Syria as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
They know exactly where the serum gas is. Obama is 100% right, and Grayson is wrong.
Mm.
Grayson, I heard his interview. He said, I want to see schools built before I let America go to war.
Mm-hmm.
That's the words he actually used.
Right.
And the fact is that many people in this country have no idea. I'm a son of survivors. And I can tell you that 190 members of my family were gassed in Auschwitz.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you that if we won't do anything now, America will look in the rest of the world, in the eyes of the rest of the world, as a paper tiger that has no teeth, just bark. And the guy in North Korea is waiting to see what we are doing.
Gotcha. I hear that. I want to make sure I get other callers too. That's a big part of the pro-action conversation. And some people, feel strongly about that, and other people are dismissing it. Let's take Ed in Philadelphia. Hi, Ed.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Hey, the reason that, there's many reasons not to get involved in this thing,
mm-hmm.
but I have a friend who does sales in the Middle East,
uh-huh.
and he says you go to Dubai, Saudi Arabia, there isn't even an Israel on the maps of
right.
the Middle East there.
Mm-hmm.
Let's forget the fact that if the Palestinians, who never friggin' had a country to begin with, would just shut up and, you know, said, okay, we're okay with these borders back in 48, they would be a Palestinian state now. But
I hear what you're saying, but I don't necessarily buy that. I think there's been a lot of provocation on the Israel side as well during that.
And
it's never been a fair fight in that regard. It's a lot more complicated, than that part of it. I get what you're saying though. George in Phoenix.
Hey, good morning, Hal.
Morning.
First of all, you have done a fantastic job in leading a conversation this week. I am so that I value so much what you've pulled off this week.
Thanks.
Wonderful job.
We're working on it. Yeah.
I'm going to make some right wing and libertarian heads explode,
mm-hmm.
but when we talk about inalienable rights, and chief among them, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, that's for all human beings, regardless of where they find themselves, doesn't matter which line they're behind, those rights, inalienable rights, need to be protected by the folks in the world who do believe that all human beings have those rights.
Right. I don't necessarily, I appreciate the call. I don't necessarily think the right is going to agree with you on that, because I think they believe those rights start at our borders. And if you want them for your country, you're going to have to go build them yourself. never mind the fact that you may have been in the process of doing that and we interrupted you when you were doing that. Katie in Hudson, Mass.
Hey, Hal. Listen, all your analogies all week, especially like when you were with Rick Overton.
Rick's
talking
great.
About the script being rewritten when you were talking about religion and how, like, Judaism was sort of preempted by Christianity, you know,
mm-hmm.
and all that. That was just sadness. But that's
it was the salmon pages in the Bible, the New Testament being a rewrite, basically, of the original script, right? Yeah.
Just that whole conversation all week. You have been great.
Thanks.
The previous caller's compliments. But just the thing, when you were talking about how, like, food aid is just, you know, it's all girly and pinky and feminine. It just struck me that the homophobia of that versus the
mm-hmm.
Military use of our power. But I always think of that's how we should spread democracy anyway, is through humanitarian efforts. That's
absolutely
the whole point of us as a country, is we were based on the principles of humanitarian rights.
Right.
I mean, that's
I'll tell you
what
why,
it was all about.
You want to know why I could not agree more? And I'll tell you exactly why we don't. One is that it's viewed as a form of forced charity. Right now, if you want to do food stamps for our own people, there are huge swaths of the government, especially the right wing, that will say that that's just creating weakness and making everybody come to us for what they need. So instead of working for themselves, they're going to go to the government to solve their problems. And they're afraid that international aid in the form of food and medical supplies does that to the rest of the world, that the rest of the world somehow won't form businesses and grow as human beings if they can always rely on us for snacks. But they're completely cool with if we have a problem militarily, you guys can bomb on our behalf.
I know.
Which is another form of charity, right?
If you look at organizations like Kiva.org that invest in people and invest in that,
right.
That's what we're talking about. But
I agree.
You know,
we gotta take a break. I'm right up against the hard break. But thank you, Kiva.org. Take a look at it. Because that That's probably the issue most of the times. Lack of communication. Too many problems the world can't solve. Look at that. I mean, who knew that Rat was writing songs about the Syria conflict in 1983, 82, 82, probably when this was written? Came out the next, 84 was, yeah, something about that. Okay, let's take more calls. 1-800-STEP-12 is the number. Let's go to Joe in Chicago. Hi, Joe.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I love your show.
Thanks.
I just wanted to talk a little bit about the situation here and about as far as I'm a big supporter of Obama from Chicago here, but I just am sorry. I just wish the whole thing that really perplexes me, that really is the crux of this whole thing, is I wish we didn't have this. Everyone is against this Big Brother thing. They don't think the United States should be handling problems everywhere else. But I think that at the beginning of all that is when we started by saying we were going to draw the line in the sand and we weren't going to put up with the use of chemical weapons. And I think someone kind of tempted us and someone kind of called us on it to see if we would do something about it.
This is, and again, an honest question. Technically speaking, he was referencing... and he said this in his follow-up, and everybody, you know, characterized it as a back-away, this is a world's red line. This is not his own personal red line. Like, it's not that he has a problem with chemical weapons, even though he does. That's not what he's talking about. The world has a chemical weapons treaty. That was decided. We don't have a cluster bombs treaty. we've been trying. We barely have the landmine treaty, but we got over 180 countries that signed on to the chemical weapons ban. Isn't that what he means by red line? And doesn't any country who uses them call out all of those countries?
Well, I think that because of our reputation as the United States as being the person who really polices basically the world on these types of things, I think they really were calling us out by using it. And I think the president was probably more surprised after his statement that someone would use chemical weapons after that was stated, because of the United States' history of actually carrying through with what we say. We say, hey, you're going to cross that line, you're going to pay for it. And someone actually did it and called us on it. Now he's right. Basically forced in a position where he's saying, okay, we have to do something here no matter what Congress says. And there's people in North Korea, there's people in Iran, there's other leaders that are out there waiting to see what we will do.
I'm curious. Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I've heard that argument repeatedly. Here's another question, though. In a discussion, you're the president. You are President Bush or President Obama. You have an idea about what you think your foreign policy should be. You yourself. You are actually a representative leader of a country. And you are being asked by a reporter, the Syrian conflict has been going on for almost 2 years now. We have armed the rebels to some degree after a certain thing, but is there a point to which the United States involvement would be higher than it is now? Is there? What would your answer have to be? What would you have to say in that interview as the President of the United States?
Well, you. I would have to say that right now it has to be this limited. I think we have to do a limited strike.
No, I mean back when he said it was a red line.
Oh, when it was a red line, I think it's almost one of those things where we probably should have thought a little bit more before the words came out of our mouth, because that kind of almost was a commitment in a way.
Isn't that the truth, though? I mean, I understand what I'm trying to get to here is that I know what the post quarterbacking has been about that particular line, but how do you, literally say we have treaties and behaviors and we actually think action is our place in the world? That's true. And you just said you would be for, to some degree, limited strikes. What would you have said at that moment asked by that reporter? Would you have said no comment and let it sit so you would avoid that point? Or would you have said there is no point at which the United States?
I'd probably have to divulge to the United Nations and say that we have to, go to the table and we have to think about what we're going to do as a group now. It seems like he went to go to the United Nations after he already said what he said. Maybe just go right to the United Nations and do what he's doing now without saying that.
I mean, I'm talking about the red line. You said that he shouldn't have said that.
Right.
And that put us in a position. I'm saying that from an international law standpoint, that you know, as a member of the, you know, as the most powerful member of the that treaty organization against chemical weapons, that when I'm asking you, when the reporter asks you, what would the, is there a point where in the Syrian conflict the United States becomes involved? If so, what would that be? What would your answer be? I'm curious.
I would say we would become involved as United Nations, as we're not going to do this on our own again. I think we learned our lessons over the years of committing ourselves on our own. I would say we're going to be doing this as a United Nations or as a group front, not just as a solely a United States front. In my opinion, I think this is a big powder keg right now with Russia and our relationships with Russia, being on the side of Syria, with Iran and other countries saying that if we bomb them, they're going to go after Israel. And this is right now, I think this is probably even a bigger powder keg than Iraq right now, with all the different countries involved and the feelings of Russia involved. And I think Russia is getting to be a little bit stronger than they were when we were in the Iraq war. They're starting to get their feet built behind them a little bit, and they're starting to show their strength where they were more quiet before in the past because their economy was so shot.
Right.
I think right now Russia is starting to get a little bit of their strength back, and they're going to start trying to push it around a little bit.
Okay, and I appreciate where you're coming from. I have a lot of calls, and I want to get to them, but what I'm trying to say is, the minute I ask somebody about that, those situations, both the red line, or what you would actually do, or what you think our position in the world is, ultimately they seem to be coming to the exact same positions that the president was in, or not answering the question. And the question is if a reporter asked you, at what point does the United States get involved in the conflict in Syria? And if your question is, never, unless there's a UN mandate, that's a big deal. That's a policy decision, and you can stand by that. That's a, you know, it's a valid one, but it has political ramifications both in the world with the leaders we are fighting with, and if Iran and Syria know that they're buddies with Russia, and Russia will veto anything the UN does, that automatically takes off the table any response you would want to do automatically, because Russia is not going to allow this. This is the, you know, now they're saying with if we have evidence, now they're being pushed, I think, by the international community, and this might be the second-tier fight of this, into going, well, did you give these guys the chemical weapons, and was this the intent of using them? And you embarrass them into shifting their behavior on the UN Security Council. Okay, we're for limited strikes. We just want to see what the plan is. That may be the direction we're going. But if you say, we're only going to do this if the UN okays it, period. End of story. That's the line. I'm drawing it as president. You abdicate your response to the UN for the length of your presidency, regardless of what you think the circumstance is, and you say that if Russia or China veto something, I'm not going to act, no matter what the interest of the United States or the safety concerns of the United States are. That, I mean, that's the ramification of saying it. I'm not saying this is any situation, not just Syria. That's your answer. But if you honestly say, well, as part of the international community that has signed onto the chemical weapons treaty, if we start seeing a lot of chemical weapons moving around, obviously we'd have to get involved, which is basically what the president said. That's essentially the red line. That's true technically of every country that's in, you know, on the treaty. But England didn't have to do that. They just said no because they know we'll pick up the slack most of the time. Their vote might not have been courageous. It might have just been, well, we don't have to do that. The U.S. will do all the bombing. That's what they always do. Roy in Orange County.
Yes. Hello. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm kind of on the fence here, and I've listened about everything you said so far. I've traveled around the world. I lived out of the country in late 70s, early 80s, and I've seen a lot of things. You know, America's never been, to me, from politically and everything else, they've never really been the humanitarian that I hear you speak about, unless there's some kind of investment or business interest that, you know, that has allowed them to say, okay, we need to get involved. And when I look at this situation.
And by them you mean we, right? You are American?
Yeah. Yes,
okay.
I am American.
All right.
Native American, actually.
All right. Well,
So my perspective is going to be a lot different from most people from the indigenous point of view, so you have to kind of bear with me here.
Okay.
So when I hear all this thing about humanitarian interests and everything, given what they're doing, America has to stop being a hypocrite. You're going to use cluster bombs and sell them to other countries that they have interests with. You can't expect everybody else to follow suit when you have a country like Russia or China or anybody else who are also becoming, you know, powers in the world, and everyone's struggling to see who controls what and what the interests are. And my biggest issue has always been about America. You've allowed businessmen to make foreign policy when most of those businessmen have no interest in the culture that they're being involved with.
Right.
And so we have gone throughout the world and have proclaimed that we are interested in humanitarian rights. At the same time, we're supporting dictators or people who have treated their people inhumanely, and we still do that today.
Right.
And at the same time, it's
absolutely.
Americans don't see it.
Right, I agree. And I think there's the blowback argument I completely hear. But again, how do you hamstring yourself by going, look, we deposed the Shah of Iran. We did that. That's on us. Our CIA just admitted it. That's that. Does that also mean that about 50 years later, you as a president could not act if the current military regime or leaders of that country did something violently illegal towards their people that would spread to another part of the world, or were start of tacitly, you know, supporting the Syrian regime and doing these things? Does that mean you can't do that because it's all started from blowback? Do you just have to automatically take it because, you know, well, I bought this guy his first drink, and now as an alcoholic, he's beating me up. So it's on me for buying him his first drink. I just got to take the beating. Or can you walk in and go, my grandfather bought him the first drink. I just met the guy and he chucked a punch at me. I've got to be able to do something. I mean, again, we're using the barroom brawl analogy. But that seems to be the case. When the blowback conversation comes up, it eliminates the modern response. Let's take a break, and then we're in our last segment. And I really want to do calls only in the next chunk because there's a lot of conversation. And we're going into the weekend with a lot of this plan. Tomorrow I'll discuss it on the House Marks Radio program, Mega Worldwide, on WCPD Radio, Chicago's Progressive Talk. But we'll get to your calls right after this break.
The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
It's the Stephanie Miller Show.
Welcome back to the Stephanie Miller Show. Last 10 minutes of me being on the show, basically, and this week. And I'll be back for Hump Days next week. And, of course, we've got the House Watch Radio program, Mega Worldwide, tomorrow on WCPT Radio. You can watch the Ustream. You can listen online on chicagosprogressivetalk.com. And we will be getting on the Progressive Voices app very soon as well. But and if you're in the L.A. area, I'm at Flappers in Burbank on Sunday doing one of my sort of regular completely improv sets, because that's what I do when I'm at Flappers. I write on the stage, and it's a lot of fun. I've written hours of new material there, and it's a terrific space for it. And, of course, my band, Zero One, is playing October 7th at the House of Blues in Los Angeles. It is our first gig with our new drummer, Dish. His name is Don Bish. We call him Dish. He's a great drummer. He was in Faster Pussycat and a couple other bands. He's a tour machine, and he's a good guy, and we will sorely miss Lance in the works of us, but he has nine other projects going, and so Dish is with us. And so October 7th, opening for Steel Panther at the House of Blues, which is the single greatest gig on the Sunset Strip right now. So if we're still alive and can have fun at that point, we will do that. I'm going to take some more calls. I want to address some people on Twitter, too, though. We had a Chris Higgins on Twitter said, Hal, if handing out food makes people dependent on our government, that isn't the U.S. making the world dependent on our military by being the police. And I totally agree. That was the point I was trying to make before we went to that last, you know, sort of ran out of time in that break, was that that's somehow it's weakness that you need food from me. You know, if you need to get food from me, you are weak and broken. And not only that, temporary, not even the temporary act of it, but that you're going to enjoy it so much that you're going to intentionally enforce your own weakness and laziness so you can continue getting stuff from me for free in the terms of food. Now, If you want me to blow somebody up on your behalf, though, but that's just natural. You know why? Because that's what a passive person does in the face of a dominant person. That's where I think the chasm exists between the two on the right wing. Giving food, you know, why have stuff? Of course you're going to want to steal my stuff. You're trying to steal my stuff. That makes you weak. But if you need me to beat somebody up on your behalf, that's because you're weak and I'm the tough one. It shows my strength, not your weakness. It's just a focal shift. But I would argue it's the same weakness. But you never hear that from the right. Let's take the last few calls. Let's go to Charles in St. Paul.
Hi. I had a happy ending for you here.
Oh, great. Yes. On my CPT show, I always do it. I end the show with a happy ending, so it's kind of appropriate. Go ahead.
Great. I was at a baseball game in St. Paul over Labor Day, and there are a couple of rather sloshy guys behind us. They were making a lot of noise, and they're kind of funny, though, but they got to arguing with the people behind them, and the people behind them were Republicans,
mm-hmm.
and they were, you know, saying, you go to Mexico, you don't want to pay taxes, and I turned to my friend next to me and said, oh, it's pretty awful when I'm agreeing with the drunk, but when I got up to leave, I turned around and I pointed to the guy and I said, you know what? He's drunk. Republicans are destroying the country. And tomorrow he'll be sober. Thank you, Winston Churchill.
Right. Exactly. way to define it. Like, you may be dumb right now, but you'll sober up in the morning. This guy's always going to be an idiot because he's chosen to be that way. Let's go to Nelson in Minneapolis. We've only got a few minutes left. So, hey, Nelson.
Okay, I'll try to make it as fast as I can.
Sure.
I totally agree with about Alan Grayson. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. When I looked at Alan Grayson last night, I thought, man, he looked like he was running for president. He took a speech from Rand Paul and he started reciting it. And I thought, okay, well, this is, I agree with you in that, you know, I can agree a lot with what Alan Grayson says, but he may have made the right choice for the absolutely wrong reasons that I just don't want to get involved. And
right.
The more I think about this, though, I think most of the American public is, I don't think we know who the bad guys are anymore.
Well, and here's the thing is, we've supported different groups that were good at one point, shifted to bad, involved some bad people, or got in a fight with the wrong guy over a tribal area, and has mucked this entire area up so much that, you know, if there's that much fighting between the GOP, you literally have the McCains and the Rand Pauls of that party who could not be more distinctly different about what their policy view is. One wants to go to war and do this. The other one doesn't want to do it ever. One wants to take a certain side. One says there is no side except the one that isn't bombing Christians, and that's the only standard that he's going to live up to. Like, how is that different from the rebels in this situation? How are they any easier to read or guide or instruct?
Well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I don't know if there are no good answers to this thing at all. And what I find the most hypocritical of all is the British House of Commons are saying, we don't want to get involved. Yet, if you really look at the history of this whole thing,
they're exactly who
yes. started it.
Right. That's you made the most of the
Syria up right. and Jordan and Lebanon. They created these dumb lines.
Well, so they wouldn't be fighting with the French anymore. Essentially, they were like, all right, we can't keep just fighting over every stretch of ground. So once we get to the Middle East, let's just start divvying it up. And you take it starting here, and I'll take it starting here. And who cares whether the tribes overlap that? You can just shoot them when they cross your border, and I'll shoot them when they cross my border. And that way, we'll eliminate them. They all try to run north. They're coming illegally across a border you established and you have, and you gun them down. When they retreat, I can say, you guys are from that side of the border, and I can shoot them this way. And, I mean, that's how they divvied up chunks of Africa. And you know, if you watch all the old money.
That worked out so well now, didn't it?
Right. So the idea that they can survive. Thank you so much for the call. Let me get to Patrick, and then we're near the end of the show. I just want to make sure I get everybody in. Hey, Patrick.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, one of your callers said someone called Obama on his red line ultimatum, and who could that someone be? You know, I applaud Obama, too, for getting this debate going. It's healthy, but it could conceivably even touch the third rail of politics, Israel.
Right.
And, you know, John Kerry's trying to make this a moral issue, but part of what this is about is keeping things stirred up and keeping all the factions divided at each other's throats. You know, Israel's going to be able to maintain their dominance of the Middle East. I think that's part of what this is about.
Yeah, they certainly have a strategic interest in doing precisely that. And it's and here's the problem. And we're out of time. But I went in on this. There are a lot of people in this conflict who can say things that are completely true, but not the whole truth. And that's what you have to keep out for. And that's what I've been trying to do all week long, is big picture this and know that lives are affected. And you have to keep both of those. We can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can do a military strike and infrastructure. It's the should conversation that's important. Thank you, Tony Sorrentino. Thank you, Rebecca Baker. Thanks, Stephen the Mooks, for letting me sit in here. We'll see you next week on Hump Days with Hal.